Intelligent design and DNA. The scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I'm Fred Williams, host of Real Science Radio. On today's show, we're going to talk about time. Is time absolute or is it relative? So what this means is that we're going to need to talk about Einstein's general theory of relativity, which argues that time is relative, and our favorite topic of late, quantum theory, which holds that time is absolute. But don't let these topics scare you into turning the dial. I promise you'll find that time will fly as we break down this fascinating topic, both from a scientific and theological perspective. I say we, as I've asked our guest host from the last 2 weeks to join me. So please welcome Daniel Hedrick, founder of the ministry God Is Now Here, emphasis on the now.
Thanks a lot, Fred. I'm really glad to be back. I really enjoyed the last 2 weeks, and I think this is going to be a really interesting topic.
Oh, no doubt. And it really ties in well with your ministry.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, as you know, when people come to the tent, they say, God is nowhere, God is now here. And I think I'd really like to kind of mention a lot about the term now, because I think when we consider absolute time and relativistic time, the concept of now is pretty important. And when I think of it, not only from the scientific framework, and we'll get into that pretty deeply, but I'd like you to just, first of all, think for a moment of the power of now. And what I mean by that is when I'm evangelizing with people, I will ask them simple questions like, what's the most important time? And people think, you know, they'll say Christmas time, birthday time, or whatever. And I'll say, no, it's now. Now is the most important time. I might even say something like, when is the only possible time to know anything?
Yeah, now. Yeah.
Right. Now is the only time you could know. And then the last one, which I think is really powerful, is when do you think the Lord would want you to know the certainty of him or anything? And again, I would say the word is
now.
Now. Exactly. So now we want to make the effort of trying to describe and understand the importance of why we accept the idea of absolute time. And we'll get into the science side of things. But that is also both there's also the ability to get into it theologically and then also philosophically.
Yeah.
So when you begin to study the nature of time or the idea or description of time, you're going to run into timelessness. You're going to run into what's called the A theory and the B theory of time. I'm sure you're quite familiar, but the A theory of time is what we want to talk about, and that's absolute time. And then the B theory of time, and this is kind of an interesting point, because if you ask, what is time? People will generally say, well, you have past events, currently present events, and events in the future that have not, you know, happened. Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, the A theory of time goes towards saying that the past doesn't exist, the future doesn't exist, only the present exists. And that term is where we get the term presentism.
Yep.
And then the second one is the B theory of time, which basically states that all time exists as one thing, I guess, if you want to say that. But the important thing is the difference between saying past and present events don't exist is to say something like those events exist, but they're earlier or they're later. And that's where we get this notion where God is outside of time, looking down at time, and he can see all of time.
Yeah.
So that's sort of a quick difference about the difference between absolute time and divine timelessness.
Yeah. And so while you were talking about that, I did a quick Google for there is no now, because that's what the secular physicists will want you to believe. And sure enough, first thing that pops up is PBS.org, there is no now, you know, for Nova, right. PBS, yep. Different examples, because, you know, and we'll get into that, because there's definitely theological implications with, just like you talked about, the either time's absolute or there's this eternal now, you know, that B type of time. So that's going to be really fun to go through that. So the science behind absolute versus relative time. I think people have already realized what we believe here at RSR, at Real Science Radio, that we believe in absolute time. We do not accept the general relativity theory, its claim that time is relative. So, aka Einstein was wrong.
I agree with that. He definitely was wrong. And I think from that, we can see, if we look into the science, I think what I accept is that the science is being presented to us all the time, mainly from secular scientists too, by the way. And so that when we have a framework that basically says that God created the heavens and the earth, obviously that's a sequential event and we came after the creator. So even just the most earliest rendition or earliest reading or easiest understanding of biblical creation says that God came before us. So yeah, that keeps it pretty simple. And we can think of that in our mind as we begin to understand science or study science. And as we learn about, you know, philosophy and theology.
Yep. And so, you know, at Real Science Radio, we expose how secular science is often, really very often wrong on the really big topics, you know, like evolution, plate tectonics, global warming. And of course, now we're positing here that they're wrong on time being relative. We think that Einstein is wrong that time is affected by gravity and relative velocity. Instead, we believe in a nutshell that gravity affects clocks, not time itself. So, Daniel, I was thinking we break the show down into four main topics. We've kind of already done a summary of, you know, the philosophical arguments of, you know, now and time. So I'd like to then break it down to where we first briefly explain in layman's terms what Einstein's general theory of relativity says about time. Then we'll discuss their primary line of evidence where they use atomic clocks. Then we'll look at the evidence against relative time, both from a scientific perspective. And then we'll also present Bob's summit clock thought experiment, which was really cool. And then finally, and this will be really exciting, we'll look at the theological implications of time as, you know, a relative physical property, or as what Isaac Newton believed and we hold to, that time is absolute. So, Daniel, can you start off by giving us a brief rundown of Einstein's general relativity?
Sure. I like the notion of understanding both general relativity and special relativity, and each one of those is an indicator, at least to Einstein and others, that the physical world impacts time. And if that's true, I mean, there are things that we can learn from that or test from that, but general relativity basically says the larger the mass, the larger there is a chance for the warping of space, and of course, in that case, time. Mm-hmm. We've probably seen all the Discovery, you know, videos where they show more or less the example of throwing a bowling ball on top of a trampoline, and then you can see how that trampoline caves in because of the weight. And that's their suggestion of how mass will change space and time.
Yeah. And so,
and that's general relativity.
Yeah. Yep. And the key point there is that Einstein introduced time as a physical thing, as a physical property, instead of time just merely being the passing of one moment to the next. So,
yeah, that's right. So it seems to me that if that's true, then, I mean, you'd have to really measure this, but that means literally my head is older than my feet, because I spend most of my time standing up.
Yep.
Right.
Well, you know, if it's true that after a million years in heaven, we're in heaven, and then we have, it's noticeable that our head is older than our feet. That's kind of weird. You know, it reminds me of the Laetoli footprints where they found, you know, these human footprints in supposed 4-million-year-old layer. So young human footprints with an old ape head. Okay, I badly digress.
That's true, you know, but as you can see, I think that, you know, as we've had all kinds of debates with people in the past, that they say things such as that there's no time in heaven, and that even that God is outside of time. And, you know, the one that I've seen my entire life is this notion that God is looking at time as a parade. And, you know, there are some very strong theological implications to that, if that's true. But we'll get back to that.
Yeah,
later.
I'm looking forward to getting into that, because that's, you know, I think a lot of us have thought about that for years, and it took me a while to come around to certain viewpoints, but I really always struggled with that. And just as a teaser, you know, I always like that verse in Revelation about how it's that verse that says there might not be any women in heaven. You know that one? there's 30 minutes of silence in heaven. sorry uh-oh, for the ladies in the audience.
Yeah. We're in trouble now.
So anyways, I mean, that one right there.
Or
says
Daniel, or yeah. Daniel in heaven, because I'm going to be a chatty man. Yeah. So it's like, uh-oh, I'm in trouble.
Yeah. So anyways, yeah, there's a verse in Revelation that says 30 minutes past of time passed in heaven. So much for the idea there's no time in heaven. But anyways,
yeah, that's exactly
we
right.
look forward to getting back to that. Because we definitely believe that Einstein's ideas that time is relative is being used by certain parts of Christianity. Just like evolution in millions of years, you know, was incorporated into many denominations.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And I think another way of let us go back, maybe back into the science a little bit here and try to talk about why it is they believe that time is being changed. And that there is a fluctuation. And that fluctuation, generally speaking, is the difference between how we might measure time, say the number of times that the Earth goes around the sun in a year, or in this case, what we want to do or what people are doing is they're measuring the time it takes for an electron to orbit around a particular atom.
Yeah, you know, they've got these next generation clocks, these strontium clocks, and they're actually accurate. They're the ones that are accurate to maybe losing 1 second over 15 billion years. So this is, I mean, these are really precise clocks.
Yeah, and I think that's amazing that they can do that. And in fact, now that they're going to do, you know, strontium, you know, I guess they're going to even be more accurate. But we also know that over a long period of time, over the past 400 years, that we've seen a decrease in the speed of light. And we know that Barry Sutterfield had been doing investigation of not only the historical past of how they measured all these periods of time where they see the decrease in the speed of light. I think if you get into that in the future, you'll find out also that the rate of which the electron goes around the atom is also decreasing. So that's really important because a lot of times people will make the indication that because of these physical properties that time must be changing. So does that mean everything has been slowing down over time? Or as we rightly say, I believe, is that the clocks are the ones that are being impacted, not time itself.
Yeah, we're going to, in the future, we plan on having a show that talks about Barry Sutterfield's idea about how the speed of light was really fast in the past and then has gradually slowed down and very gradually now slowing down. We're going to visit that idea. But yeah, so a big piece of the evidence that physicists are using to bolster the theory of relativity is that these atomic clocks we just talked about that are very accurate, is that they run faster at higher altitudes where there is less gravitational force. And that seems to confirm general relativity. But what they're missing, though, is why can't they see that? Isn't it possible it's affecting the clocks and not time? So just speaking of the precision, just last month, there was an article reported at sciencenews.org, and it was titled, "An Atomic Clock Measured How General Relativity Warps Time Across a Millimeter." So this experiment basically showed that time runs faster. Their clock, see, now they've even got me saying time. Their clock runs faster, even at millimeter sizes, where they use these strontium atoms, and they put them in a lattice, and then they're on different ladders within this 1 millimeter, and they show that the amount that the clocks change matches generally what's expected of general relativity.
Right, and I think that's amazing. I think our ability to be able to measure at this rate, it's fascinating. But I accept what you're saying. Why is that not an impact on the clock and not necessarily time? And then as Bob had a particular thought experiment, I know you know a lot more about that.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to definitely talk about Bob's thought experiment. It's really cool. It's his Summit Clock Experiment. It's on the website. We're going to go through that. And it's a really good illustration of why time is absolute and it's not relative. But there's another aspect of this whole debate on time is that quantum theory is actually like the elephant in the room, because quantum theory argues that time is absolute. It's one of those things a lot of physicists know about it, but they have not solved this problem because quantum theory does not support the idea that time is relative. You know, there's this whole thing, and Bob and I started talking about this within the last year, is Einstein's thing that he called spooky action at a distance. And there's an article this year that we have in our hands from All About Space magazine from May of 2021. It was titled, "Was Einstein Wrong? why some astrophysicists are questioning the theory of space-time. And it has to do with this whole thing of, again, of spooky action at a distance where you've got entangled particles where you can change when you observe or measure the property of one of these particles. On the other side of the universe, you get the same measurement. It's really interesting. They've got this big elephant in the room of quantum theory.
Yeah, I definitely know about the big elephant in the room, namely in quantum theory, to quote from an article that we both read together, is a gravitational field cannot be in two places at once, said Sabine Hossenfelder, a theoretical physicist at the Frankfurt Institute for Advanced Studies. And according to Einstein, space-time is warped by matter and energy. But quantum physics says that matter and energy exist in multiple states simultaneously. They can be both here and over there. So an obvious question is, where's the gravitational field? And, you know, Hossenfelder asked that. I'm asking that. Nobody has an answer to that question. And, you know, honestly, it's pretty embarrassing.
Yeah. Yep. That's what you said. It's embarrassing. So another article from Quantum Magazine titled Quantum Gravity's Time Problem puts it more plainly for the audience, and to quote senior editor Natalie Walchover, in quantum mechanics, time is universal and absolute. And you can even go to Wikipedia and look up the problem of time, and it says this. In theoretical physics, the problem of time is a conceptual conflict between general relativity and quantum mechanics, and that quantum mechanics regards the flow of time as universal and absolute, whereas general relativity regards the flow of time as malleable and relative. So just like intelligent design and information are always the big elephant in the room for evolutionists, for the time is relative crowd, the big elephant is quantum theory. I mean, I love it. It's something that Bob and I, again, spent a fair amount of time on this last year. And let's go back to entangled particles. You can make two quantum particles interact and put them at opposite ends of the universe and then measure one. Whatever measurement you get, the other particle takes on a corresponding quality instantaneously, and that's the key. So, you know, time is not relative here. And the distance doesn't matter. It could be across the entire universe, and at one instant, one particle has the corresponding quality on the other one. And the only way this can be explained is there has to be information involved, and time being relative does not fit into this equation.
I agree. And to understand quantum entanglement, I do think that there must be an information component. And it's really honestly becoming aware of what you and Bob had been talking about, you know, over the last year. And it seems like as you gain more information, it becomes more obvious. But in this case, quantum entanglement, if you think about, as an example, a pair of gloves, and if you open up a box and see a right-handed glove, then you know that it's made as left-handed. You don't even have to see it. You don't even know where it is, but you know it's there. So in quantum entanglements, it's just as if opening the box and seeing a right-handed glove actually turned the other glove left-handed. Both were in what's called a superposition of right and left-handedness until one is observed, and both change their states in relation to the other. It's what Einstein called, as we previously said, spooky action at a distance. Yep. This is also known as, isn't it Schrodinger's, how do you say that guy's name? Schrodinger's cat, right? Because it's the idea of whether there's a dead cat or a live cat inside of a box that you haven't yet opened. And it gets pretty complex because the notion is in that superposition, the cat is either both alive and dead at the same time, or it isn't alive or dead until you open the box. And this is where it gets really, really crazy. And I think studying quantum physics is a very difficult for the brain, because sometimes the intuition isn't as easy as you'd want it to be.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, at the end of John Wheeler, he categorized the end of his career as everything is information, because information is what basically you have to solve these problems. So quantum theory, without a doubt, and you know, the audience can Google this and just see the debates that are going on between quantum theorists and, you know, those who hold the general relativity. But there's definitely a conflict between the two. And they're trying to, you know, figure that out and iron it out. And a lot of them, they want to really stick to time is absolute. But it's an interesting ongoing battle. And we'll see, you know, where the truth leads. We know that the Bible we can look at the Bible and get a really good idea where the truth is on all of this. And we're going to get in again to the theological implications.
You know, Fred, what I was thinking also is the importance of having accurate time. So we're sitting here thinking about, well, if time's relative and I'm standing here and you're standing there, you know, are we even talking to each other in the same moment? You know, all these weird thoughts that might happen. But what I'd like you to just consider, we're both in computer technology, is that we know that we need to have accurate time. So this is more of a secular, a materialist problem. And the way in which we've done that in the past is using what's called an epoch date. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Oh, absolutely. So I mean, we used epoch time when I worked at Trimble for our GPS tracking devices. Yeah.
Please speak about that. I think it's pretty relevant.
Well, yeah. So, you know, epoch time is the number of seconds since January 1st, 1970. So it's a way to have a point of reference for your clocks that you use. A lot of software development companies with their embedded products, they use epoch time, which, by the way, is going to roll over. I can't remember when, but something like in 2045 or something, that clock rolls over, the 32 bits. That's going to be interesting. But, you know, I always joke that, you know, I'll be long retired by then, and so I don't care.
Well, you
that's
know,
a
it's
problem
interesting.
They'll have to deal with.
Sure, but you know what's also interesting here is that when we have our computers set up as you just did, and you used epoch time to make sure that you're, quote, on the same time, I don't know if you know this, but from an information security perspective, we monitor all the transactions that go through a corporate network. And even if you have a server, a gateway, being set at the wrong time, literally set, you know, let's just pretend, you know, January 18th, 1842. Well, probably not 1842. We'll go ahead and say 1940 or 1989 or something like that. The point is the date's completely wrong. It won't matter. And the reason why is because the transaction is embedded with that epoch date. So it's interesting. Even if your clock is wrong, you can still get the time right.
Exactly. And I just Googled really quick. It's called the year 2038 problem. So that's when that epoch clock will wrap. So
right. That sounds just like the year 2000 problem.
You know, oh, yeah. And I'm sure there'll be lots of people saying it'll be the end of the world. And then, you know, if we're still cranking along with, you know, this ministry, we can see if we can get people to, you know, donate
help
all their.
Us out.
Yeah. Don't give us their house since they think the world's going to end. And we'll gladly take it.
So let's see if there's a way to potentially for in the future, are there any experiments that we can go through? I know we had Bob's experiment. We'll talk about that. But, you know, one of the most important ones, I think, is that I think there are five planets that we've been measuring, you know, for over 400 years. And that's just because we've been able to observe them. And then other planets were a little bit too far away for our, let's say, our ancestors to observe. But the idea is that these measurements over time, there really hasn't been much drift. And as an example, an amateur with a telescope, he goes out and he looks up at Jupiter. And before he puts his telescope out there, he's looked down at a survey that says when the red spot is going to rotate across the central meridian. Mm-hmm. And as sure enough, he looks up, he's looking through his telescope, and there it is. And that's observational evidence. And mm-hmm. what's interesting is that data was written down months and months ago, probably years ago. The point is you don't have to actually be there to know that that orbit is going to be accurate. And so that's really important. So if we see that the orbital mechanics and orbital references of all of the satellites of our entire, you know, solar system, that's very predictable. And I think you guys have done some shows in the past where you can show exactly where the stars were in the heavens and relate that to, you know, astrological details or astronomical details. Very, very interesting on that. And then the other bit is some of the speed of light experiments that we've talked about, and specifically the aberration of measurements in the past at mm-hmm. the Bulkova Observatory. And I think they did the measurement from 1839 all the way to 1941. That's a pretty long time to be measuring the speed of light.
Yep.
And sure enough, they have shown during that time 150,000 K per second faster. So how is that possible that you have the decrease over time from the beginning until now? So you see that one thing stays stable and another one changes.
Yep. So, and again, that's going to be really cool to go through the whole Barry Satterfield thing. You know, his theory isn't widely accepted by creationists, but it was always respected, and not like summarily dismissed either. So it's going to be interesting to look at that, because there is data, like you're talking about. There is evidence of this slight slowing of the speed of light. And then, you know, how it plays into the whole is time relative argument. So, you know, we're actually getting kind of low on time. I wanted to go through Bob's Summit Clock experiment and his thought experiment, which is pretty cool and involves a
Sure.
clock on at the base of Cheyenne Mountain, and then a clock that's at the top of Cheyenne Mountain. And we know that the clock at the top of Cheyenne Mountain is going to tick slightly faster. We have really strong evidence for that. But again, we say that it's because the clocks are affected by gravity and not time itself. So I think we're probably going to need a part two to this show. Well, I know we are, because we are. It's going to take a little time to go through the Summit Clock experiment, and then Daniel, I really want to get into the theological implications, because they really are important. And as you know, it's kind of the difference between if you hold to Calvinistic beliefs. You know, everything's predetermined. This actually is related to the topic we're discussing, and I think it'll be really cool to go through that.
Oh, I look forward to speaking about it. It's one of my favorite topics.
Yep. And I learned that topic from you, actually. It got me first. The first time I started thinking about whether or not God is outside of time, you introduced it to me. I'm like, that's interesting. It took me about a year to wrap my head around it. And as you know, kind of an inside baseball about it got me in a little bit of trouble with my creation
Sure.
organization. That's a whole
And
nother
I'm so
story.
glad that I could be a part of that. You know, I really am glad that I can be the disruptor, you know, in that case.
Yep. So to summarize, here at RSR, Real Science Radio, we definitely believe that, at least as it pertains to time being relative, we think Einstein is wrong on that. There's plenty of physicists out there that are also disputing this because of what we've learned from quantum theory. So, and everybody, we still need your help to stay on the air. We're still in the telethon month of November, so there's still time to become a sponsor for a show. So if you go to rsr.org, there's information at the top of the website to be a part of that. We could really use your help. We love keeping ourselves on the air, you know, at AM 670, Fridays at 3 o'clock. And then from there, we put it on the website, and then you can listen to it on podcast. And I'm learning more about podcasts from my son. You know, he kind of roasted me when he was on the show with me about my lack of knowledge of how all that works. But again, as long as you know how to do a podcast, you'll know what to do. For a guy like me, kind of a dinosaur with that stuff, I just go to the website, rsr.org, and I click on the link if I want to listen to a show that I wasn't able to catch live on air on Fridays at 3 o'clock. So, Daniel, I look forward to doing a part two of this show. Can't wait to have you back next week. So for Daniel Hedrick and Real Science Radio, this is Fred Williams. May God bless you.